and welcome to the Afro Reads podcast with your hosts,
Amara
and Ugochi.
Afro Reads is a book review podcast that was created out of our shared love for reading African fiction books.
We talk through its themes and try to tie its key messages to our African heritage, culture, and contemporary issues.
We invite you to turn the page and let's begin.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Afro Reads Podcast, where we read and review African books by African authors. I am your host, Ugochi, and I'm joined by my co-host, Amara. Would you like to say hi?
Hi, it's been a minute, but yes, it's good to be back.
And we are joined by our very special guest, Manny Mengisti.
Hello.
Hi. Manny, would you like to introduce yourself? Tell us where you're from, what you do, how you got into your love for reading.
Yeah. So my name is Manny. I was born and raised in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. I guess it'll make sense in the context of this book why I'm a guest. I currently live in Massachusetts in the East Coast of the United States, specifically in the Boston-Cambridge area, where I'm a graduate student. Not in, you know, literature or English or anything like that. I just happened to like to read. How did I start to like to read? I think I had parents who were very encouraging of it and who bought me a lot of books. And I was kind of a quiet. And so books were like a natural companion throughout my life. And that's been a habit that I've retained, thankfully, as I've gotten older.
And would you like to tell us about your book club?
Oh, yeah, of course. So I guess the way that we got in touch was through a book club that I'm a part of, also based in Boston, called Fidel Literary and Arts. It's a book club that centers books and literary works by authors from Ethiopia or the African diaspora. Yeah, and we kind of got connected through that.
Nice. How long have you guys been a book club?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I calculated, and I think we're coming up on our fifth anniversary, I think this coming May. So the book club's existed in one form or the other for 5 years. It's gone through different iterations. Like in the beginning, we were very intent on reading books in one of the native languages in Ethiopia, Amharic. And then we expanded to reading works by Ethiopian authors also in English. And then we've expanded to like reading works by African authors or authors in the African diaspora more broadly. And we kind of rotate between the three kinds of books and we like cycle through that. And yeah, it's been a real blessing and a gift to be part of the book club.
Yeah. Nice.
Nice.
All right. So usually we do our current events, anything that's happened in Africa in the past few months. So who wants to go first? Do you want to go first? Do you have any? No.
I want to go first because for the first time, like I actually have a story that happened this week and I actually researched. So my story is from Nigeria, actually. And this week was like a landmark case in the UK. So they basically convicted a Nigerian senator for the crime of organ harvesting. So they convicted him and his wife. He was arrested last year in May for allegedly bringing over, then they were saying he was an underage 15-year-old, but the guy lied, basically a 21-year-old street hawker to the UK to basically donate his kidney, one of his kidney, to the senator's daughter, who is going through like a kidney disease and has to be on dialysis twice a week. And I think it's progressively obviously getting worse. So, you know, the usual, this spiel of, okay, power dynamics. And I think that's what makes it illegal in the UK. And that's why they don't do organ harvesting. If you need an organ, you wait on the list and you ensure money doesn't exchange hands, right? So they brought this guy over, obviously, you know, as the court has now said, you know, offered to like pay him or give him a good life. And then they coached him and then lied on his papers that he was related to them. It was a cousin. There was like a middleman as well, like doing all the interactions. So they interviewed him at the hospital, and the hospital were alarmed already that, you know, this donor doesn't even seem to know what he's doing here, and he doesn't seem to understand the questions or understand what's going on. So they stopped the transaction. The plan was to send him back to Nigeria, right? No police was involved yet. So the plan was to send him back to Nigeria, and then along the way he ran away, slept in the streets of London, and then reported himself to the police and just told them this is what's going on. And yeah, so the senator and his wife were arrested in the airport. They were like under key investigating them, and then as soon as they landed in the UK, because they always have to be in the UK because their daughter is on dialysis. As soon as they got to the airport, they arrested him last May, and they've been in prison. The woman was released on bail. But yeah, as this week, for this week, they were both convicted. Sentencing is in May. And yeah, the woman was basically dragged to prison, the man as well, who had been in prison. And the daughter was obviously left devastated in tears. Yeah, that's the story.
I think you did. I remember now, you did tell me.
The reason it's quite landmarky because it's the first time in the UK that people have been actually tried and convicted of organ harvesting. So I think, and not to obviously belittle the case, but I think obviously it's a landmark case that the UK was not going to let go of. Like, apparently they are seeking the maximum sentence. So everyone's kind of waiting for that. They are seeking the maximum sentence. They've never let him out on bail. They've kept him in prison. So they are not joking with this case. It's very, very high profile. But on the same side, it also shows like what any parents would be willing to do for their child. Obviously, as Africans, we kind of do things very haphazardly. He had passed laws in Nigeria against organ harvesting, like
Oh,
in his
really?
past life. Yeah, he was one of the senators that have signed bills against. So this is obviously carelessness and just not thinking properly. Yeah, it's very gray, but coming to the UK is very black and white.
Don't know if it's carelessness or not thinking properly, or does he feel like he's above the law?
So from what I heard in the court documents, the defense was claiming they didn't really know much about the donor because they used a middleman who was also convicted. So bad gist, and I'm going to stop there because this is going to drag on. The bad gist, the reason why they called the middleman is that I think previously he had gotten a kidney himself through that way, right? And it was successful, the same hospital, the same everything. I think now they're doing investigation on that. But he had gotten the kidney through that way. So this was just, okay, it worked for you. Can you connect us to do this? So he was the one doing all the transactions while the senator didn't really know much about the donor. But where they really caught them, they were like, you didn't know much about the donor, but you lied that the donor was a cousin of yours, right? So that's where, like, the court, the judge, the jury, nobody was letting go of, right? The girl was also tried, the girl with the kidney issues, because it was all in her name, but they let her go. So she was found not guilty because she has a lot of things to deal with. But so it's just her parents. What do you think, Manny? Look at
I
your
mean,
Look, I can see your face right now.
it's a really harrowing story. I mean, I think part of it is like parents' desperation, you know. I've had family members go through, like, I have family members currently have like hereditary kidney problems, not through my line, but like cousins removed. And so I know how difficult and challenging, like,
And
needing and
expensive.
expensive a kidney transplant and, like, you know, twice a week kidney dialysis is. And then,
$5, I think, each
yeah.
time.
And then to have your to watch as a parent to watch your child go through that, I can empathize with that. But I can also empathize with basically the exploitation of this young person who essentially was, you know, asked to give up. I don't even know if they had like informed consent, right? Like what the procedure entailed, what they were getting into, the fact that they were giving up an organ.
Yeah, no, he really, really like spelled it out in court. I didn't know, I didn't know, I didn't know. Like, Again, I've heard rumors that he probably maybe have known, but because he didn't want to go back to Nigeria, he thought this was his chance to stay in the UK and report. Like, I don't know, I've heard different things, but the truth is, yeah, he had a good case. He's now being like praised as a hero for coming forward, you know. And I think they said a charity has taken him in, a charity that deals with like traffic people have taken him in, and they're trying to rebuild his life in the UK.
That's good.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, it's a positive. I also feel sorry for the daughter too. I mean, what if she didn't know, I guess, the ins and outs of what her parents were doing?
Yeah.
So she's probably gotten her hopes up
Oh my
that
God. And
something
the
might.
worst thing was that I think they had evidence that because it didn't work in the UK, they were making plans to go to Turkey. Like everything was just stacked against them. There's a whole, like, they were getting ready. I think that's why they were even in the airport when they were caught. Like they were getting ready to go and do the same thing in Turkey. So it
Yeah.
was just never ending.
They felt like
Yeah.
they're above the law, in my opinion.
Yeah,
But
no, above the law. And you know, unfortunately, I don't know, Manny, I don't know if you get this in Ethiopia as well. Like it's so gray, the air, like it's such a gray area. I mean, the courts and persecution, it kept talking about power dynamics. And you know, even if the guy agreed to come and because I think they offered him like £7,000, that even if he agreed, that it's still illegal because of the power dynamics. But in the Nigerian context, we live on power dynamics, right? We live on patronage system. So it's such a gray area. He would have definitely gotten off if he was in Nigeria.
I mean, but he signed the law to make that illegal in Nigeria.
Let me tell you, when they said he signed the
Yes,
law, the person that said he signed the law immediately said, but implementation has been hard. And that's with all laws. FGM is a big thing in Africa. They are still cutting people, but there are laws against it. So what happens on paper, or to maybe like you have a story on Uganda, right?
yeah.
To like please the UN or whatever. That's not what happens in real life.
Yeah.
African countries are very good at differentiating the two, especially African leaders. They know when to lie. Yeah.
Well, speaking on, I guess, the UN
Yeah.
and appeasing to them. So Uganda has decided not to appease to the UN. They're proposing to introduce a death penalty bill for I guess people who practice aggravated homosexuality.
Aggravated.
Aggravated.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah.
What? I don't know, rape.
I don't know. So I had looked up aggravate means to make something worse.
Ah, okay.
So aggravated homosexuality. So
Maybe acting on it.
maybe acting on it.
I mean, I feel like it's the law that's going to criminalize everything and anything because it's so like vague. What is
Is
aggravated? Yeah.
yes. But homosexuality already is illegal. So now they're just trying to introduce the death penalty. So on Tuesday, the law was passed in Parliament, so now it's just sitting with the president to sign. So we'll
So
see.
I also read that today or listened to a podcast. So yeah, like Museveni is keen on banning it. And he also said that because the UN and the US, they've also like started whispering and saying, if you do this, you know, you're gonna cut arms, you're gonna cut aid, you're gonna do this, blah, blah. And he was like, if you like do it, but if you do that, just know you're basically declaring genocide. So he's very strong on.
Yeah, and throughout the years, the West have been pressuring him to allow homosexuality and I guess the act of it in Uganda. And he's said, no, that's not our concern right now. So, because in interviews, they'd always make it a talking point. Why is it illegal? And he would always say, like, you know, that's not necessarily a concern. People are hungry. Our infrastructure needs building up. Why are you talking about things that we don't have the, I guess, the energy to worry about right now, what our focus on is on living.
But I can turn the question around and say, okay, but if you're a homosexual, how is it affecting you? Why do I have to face the death penalty or go to jail? Why can't you just focus on the fact that I'm hungry? You understand? Rather than the fact that I want to sleep in the same gender as me. Why are you so worried about that?
That's a good question, because if he's answering that type of question with the
Yeah.
interviewers,
Yes.
his focus should not necessarily be on
How about
the
that? How
death
about you
penalty
just
on
leave that? Unless he links it to something serious, like his cousin, then yeah, I don't know. Manny, what do you think?
I mean, I think that I think I agree spot on with the like inversion of that question, right? I mean, you can't on one hand say that you don't care and this isn't like a big point of interest or worry, and on the other hand, spend resources, legislative power, enforcing power, basically, you know, having the state kill people who happen to be queer. And then say that, oh, you don't care and you just want to focus on development and infrastructure and things like that. I mean, clearly you do. You're enacting, you're thinking about enacting laws that are going, that upholding laws that oppress certain groups of people and then enacting laws that essentially would exterminate them in the country. Yeah, I don't know. I did remember. That happened. The news cycle is so fast, it feels like so many things are happening. But yeah, I did hear about that. And yeah, I think that, yeah, I think I guess I just, you know, solidarity to a lot of people who I'm sure are feeling very, very scared right now in Uganda. And then, yeah, I think with these kinds of laws, also the thing that always gets me is that they tend to be very vague, right? And if there's provisions for sort of people ratting other people out, right, that could be super disastrous, even for people who didn't think that they would have been criminalized by the law. It only takes someone to like hate you or whatever. So I think in that way, I think it's also like a real threat to everybody's freedom, not just the freedom and liberty of queer people. Yeah, so
It'd be interesting to hear from someone who's part of that the LGBTQ community in Uganda to see, I guess, their experience as it is right now. I think the law is definitely a stretch, but on the other side, he's saying, or people who support him say he's trying to protect their traditions. And I can understand because he might see the West and how things are going there, and maybe want to put this type of law into place. Not saying it's right at all, but I'm saying just kind of send a message that we are not going to adhere to, or we don't prescribe to what you guys are doing.
A discussion with a guy yesterday, and he went on this whole thing of like he wants to marry like a black woman to kind of have black babies and let the world be black. No, it's not funny. He explained it to me and it sounded rational, I guess, but I think I was trying to, I came in with the whole like, you're basically saying westernization is bad and we shouldn't like mix and whatever, whatever. But you're also in the UK, like, enjoying the resources and the benefits. And the same thing with Uganda. Like they are one of the countries that have benefited from international development. So, and I'm not saying any way is right or wrong, but I'm just saying there's always that conflict of we're enjoying what you're giving us, so westernized, we wear our suits, we our schools and whatever is developed. I mean, all these traditions you're talking about, they were killing twins, right?
That's
In
true.
like in some Nigerian traditions, and FGM is still quite harmful to women and all that, depending on the perspective you look at it. So it's not all that bad. So I just find it crazy that people just cherry pick, and it's now homosexuality you want to you is homosexuality mountain you want to die upon. But yeah, it's not good or bad, but it's just an interesting thing about human leadership that, yeah.
I mean, I think this will come back maybe if we talk about sort of the feminist aspects of the book that we're going to discuss. I think it'll come back in that as well. But I think it's very similar in Ethiopia. I think people have a way of at least, I don't know, I think it's like this almost confused melding of like this like hyper independence that we want to have as Africans, as you know, formerly colonized people or people who basically have fought against colonization efforts and Western imperialism. There's this urge to sort of fight against that. But then also I think there's kind of a forgetfulness about positive aspects of learning from other people's cultures. And also, in this particular case, a lot of queer theorists actually in recent years have studied like pre-colonization African cultures, and they found that in a lot of places, the senses of what gender is, for instance, is very different. Like there are cultures where, cis men would, for ceremonial purposes or otherwise, assume gender expressions that are very feminine or things like that, right? And so people argue that it's actually with the onset of colonialization and the coming of evangelical Christianity onto the continent that, the gender binary was established on the continent and sexual relations between people were also very like binarily defined. I don't know how much that is true for Uganda because I don't really know the history in depth there, right? So I think it also forgets that the notions of gender and sexuality that already exist currently on the continent were introduced by the West as well, right? So even that, I think there's a point to be made about like, okay, if you're going to critique Western influence, then I think you should also like look at the current cultures and sort of see how they, what does it mean to be, purely a African or purely Ugandan? And then even beyond that, is that a good enough reason to like implement something or to not, right? Just because it's the way that we've always done things or the way that we are doesn't mean that. You brought up FGM, and I think that's a really good example, right? That's been an entrenched practice all over the continent. And for a lot of people, that's just the way that we've done things. But I think as a society and as people, we've realized that that's a very harmful thing to do. So we have to like progress and move past that,
And for the audience, FGM is female
genital mutilation.
Yeah.
All right. So back to you.
So, do you have any current event that you want to share?
No, I think this was you guys did a
This was good.
fantastic
All
job. Yeah.
right. Okay. So I guess we'll go into the book now. So Amra will take us through a bit of a summary of what we read.
So yeah, this book is like 400 and something pages, so it was very, very hard to summarize. Like, I think, yeah, so I'm going to do my best. So The Shadow King by Mahaza Mengistu is a book. I think it was published in 2019, but the book sheds light on basically the victory or some victories of on the Ethiopian side during the Second Italo Ethiopian War 14, 1936, exactly 40 years after the Ethiopians defeated the imperialist Italy in the Battle of Adwa. The peculiarity of this book also shines light on the fact that, women soldiers were ever present and they fought alongside the men in the war, but this has been largely left out of formal history accounts. The main character, Hirut, is an orphaned maid, and the book kind of follows her life living with the warlord Kidane and his wife Aster. And it follows on how she prepares alongside them for the battle and how she was quite significant in ensuring that victory by the end of the book. I missed all that. As she was preparing for battle with them, she also went through a lot of trauma, a lot of domestic abuse, in the hands of Aster, who was always like envious of her relationship with her husband, and Kidane, who was basically raping her sometimes when he felt like it. On the other hand, in the Italian camp, we had the army who was encroaching in on smaller villages. And they camped outside on the outskirts of Kidane's kind of village, right? So the book takes us through all their battles, their victories, their triumphs, and also their defeats on both sides. So Kidane's side and the Italian side, which was headed by Fucelli, Colonel Fucelli, or General Fucelli. He also had a photographer, Ettore, who throughout the escapade, should I say, of the Italian army, he was photographing key moments as a sort of trophy, to show Italy that they were actually winning the war, and And yeah, this it led to like crazy moments of him photographing people as they were jumping to their deaths, as they were being executed and pushed off the cliff, and also photographing the women prisoners who were often naked, raped, and abused by the army. Finally, Hirut and Aster, the two main characters, were captured and put into the Italian concentration camps. And obviously, Kidane, as the warlord, heard about it and like rallied his team and rescued them and finally won that victory, which is around where the book ended. Obviously, the beautiful thing about this book is that it had a backdrop of the Holocaust. So as we are talking about concentration camps in that the Italians set up in Ethiopia, as we are talking about them like annihilating villages with chemical weapons and with other very illegal tactics, and as we are talking about like them basically performing genocide, there's a whole backdrop of what was happening in Ettore and Fucelli's country. The fact that I think they were both Jewish, or at least Ettore was Jewish, and the fact that this exact same thing were happening to his parents, and no one really understood the irony of that right through the end of the book. The Shadow King concept came from the fact that the emperor, amidst the encroachment of the Italian army, fled to Bath in the UK. And as a result of his self-exile, this kind of weakened the morale of his people. So luckily, they found a lookalike amongst Kidane's camp, a guy called Minim, whose name means nothing, who stood in as the king in makeshift outfits, and Hirut was put beside him as his soldier. Yeah, so that's how the concept of the Shadow King came about. And people believed, and the villagers and the Ethiopian soldiers did believe he was king, and that boosted their morale enough to keep fighting and pushing the Italians away. Other interesting characters were Fifi. She was a prostitute for Italian soldiers and also acted as a double agent that fed information to Kidane's camp. And then the ever presence of the cook. I can't really describe her. She was just a presence. She was almost like a shadow herself throughout the whole book. And, just always fighting in her corner, even if she also had a very traumatized childhood. The end of the book is Hirut at a train station with Ettore delivering his box of le letters and pictures from the war almost 40 years later in the 70s. And again, there's a beautiful backdrop of students, rioters, protesting the reign of the emperor, who had now become diminished in mental capacity. So I that's the good thing about the book, because it circles round right up. Like you can tell it was, well, I think it was you that told me that it took the author, Manny, yeah, you said it took the author about 10 years to write. It shows in the book. That's the amazing thing. So so that's the summary of the story. So sorry guys, I've kind of ruined it for you, but yeah, read the book before you listen to this podcast.
Disclaimer on
All
in the
right.
beginning.
So got you, over to you.
Okay, so we'll go into our questions. Okay, so the first question is, how does the idea of a shadow king relate to the female characters in the book? So do you want to go
No,
through?
actually, this was one question that I hoped to hear your thoughts about it, because you said something last week that was like, I've talked about this book with a ton of people, and you two were the first people who like
Brought
talked
that.
about the metaphor of the Shadow King. So yeah, take it
Yeah.
away.
Okay. So I was reading. I don't know why. So yes, Minim, I guess, is what the Shadow King was referring to. But I always look at, different things when I'm reading the book, not obvious things. And I thought the women, because they were so strong in the book to me, and were doing so much in the background, that they were sort of the Shadow Kings. And that movie The Woman King came to mind when they were
Yeah,
fighting.
I
That I
agree.
guess that last the one of the last scenes. When I hear Shadow King, I think of them more so than what's his name?
Minim.
Minim.
Minim,
Oh,
yes.
you think more about them being Shadow Kings
Yes, than Minim.
than Minim.
Minim, I guess, is the literal Shadow King that they refer to, but the women carried it out in practice, I think.
Okay, well, it'd be good to hear. Give an example, any of your, because there were four major female characters. There was Hirut, Aster, the cook, Fifi. So give an example of how they showed they were Shadow Kings. 2 minutes to think about your answer. Just one example of how you think one of the women like embodied the Shadow King, whatever.
So an example for me is Hirut. I think she's a very strong female character, and she's always been strong throughout the book. But I think when she was raped by Kidane is when she maybe realized her true power. So it said that, you guys have to help me remember.
No, it's fine.
Yeah, but it. When before the actual rape, she was kind of fighting it, right? She yelling and
She was
screaming,
yelling and screaming, and
kind of
then,
fighting it. She was yelling and screaming, but then the actual when the actual rape was happening, it seemed like she her mind rose above, and then she found her strength versus Kidane, where he needed that to feel empowered, but that's taking advantage of someone, to feel empowered, which is a bit weak,
I just
right?
love the fact that she said yawning. She was like, yeah, you do. And then immediately she started like just ignoring him, right? He just stopped.
And she did say that she's gonna, at the end of this, she's gonna kill him.
And she killed him.
And she killed him.
It. She actually killed him.
Yeah. So that's the strongest example I can give of a female character. I mean, there's Aseer also.
But Manny, did you have an example?
I was gonna go with Hirut, but then second, I was gonna go with Fifi, who is literally like in the shadows and almost, if I'm remembering this correctly, she was kind of seeing Fucelli, this person that everybody feared and was the boss and all of that stuff. And it seemed like in the shadows she had some control over him as well, right? So I thought, taking the metaphor of Shadow King, that was another thing that she was a character that reminded me of that, like literally working in the shadows and having some control and some power in the shadows.
Definitely. What about
Yeah,
you?
Oster, to me, I always like it when like characters in a book or a movie are not perfect. So they are not bad and they are not good. You don't leave the, I don't know, production thinking, oh, this was a really bad person. And I think Oster embodies that for me because, yeah, even if she was very nasty in her to her maid, you can tell she was projecting, from her relationship with the cook as a child and the way she was also given to her husband as well. So there was a lot of projecting. And towards the end of the book, they were basically kind of friends. Kind of friends, kind of, yeah. And I just like the fact that, despite a lot of losses in her life, again, how she became a wife and then also the death of her son, she was willing to rise above and still command the women right up to the very end. She didn't, because she had a lot of depression, right? But she rose above and did what she needed to do. She was basically present when her husband was raping Hirut and again just carried on with what needed to do right up to the end. I don't know how that relates to Shadow King, but I just wanted to point out that was badass.
She was able to lead the women.
Lead the women. She trained Hirut and Minim on how to become a king and a king's soldier, whatever. So she did a lot. Like, I think. Really, part of their victory, half, in fact, a good 50% was Aster. So, yeah, again, but she wasn't mentioned. Like, Okay, a part that stood out to me, right, was when I think she said, I can make gunpowder, and you know, my mom or whatever is the one that taught me how to make gunpowder. However, throughout the book, you only hear about Kidane's father 40 years ago and when they fought in the war. You hear about Kidane's father and his uncles, and I'm just like, but from Aster, you can see that there were women that made gunpowder out of nothing, no resources to fight this war, you know? So yeah, so Aster is a very was a very interesting character for me.
Okay, so going to the second question. The perception of rape seemed to be divided along the lines of gender. What do you guys think of that? You want
So,
to?
this question, I don't even know how I formulated it, but I
I think it
think,
was because of me.
no, but I think I was trying to say that in Kidane's mind as a man, he wasn't doing anything bad. Oh, I don't know, the kicking and screaming should have indicated, but then what's no, right? Exactly, right?
Right, exactly.
So, in his mind, and then he talks about, I think his father had done the same thing. All the men in the camp, like, they were like, okay, this is not our business. Only Akilu that was like giving him side eye, but he was giving him side eye because his love interest was in the mix of things. So it was just like drinking beer, you know?
Yeah, and I guess I don't want to, maybe part of culture or the male upbringing. So when, I don't know about this particular culture, but when he got married, they were like pumping him up
Yeah, like it was a whole
to, it's
ceremony.
a whole ceremony to have sex with the with your wife, and it and you becoming a man. So I think in his mind and a lot of their minds, they didn't see rape as how we see rape today. Versus for the women is very uncomfortable.
Was so like from the start to the end, like he started with us there and you know, just thinking it was wrong, 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 wrong. Right up to Hirut, you know, fighting and screaming. So I think I wrote this question because I was just like, but they were existing in the same era, right? So why was it so different? And why did no one address it? You know.
So to offer some like cultural context to this, in parts of Ethiopia, there's a very prevalent tradition called metlef, which is basically the kidnapping of your bride in order to attain a bride, right? Essentially, and it can look like, you know, young women as young as 12, 11, 10, going to the river to get water. And them being kidnapped,
And then what
and
happens
essentially,
after they are kidnapped, please?
oh, the kidnapper marries them, and this is like very socially sanctioned, and this practice was very common for sure at the time that this book is being referenced to. In fact, the first case where a person who was being kidnapped fought back and actually killed their attempted kidnapper was in the 90s. And that person was brought to trial for murder. And it was established that it was actually in self-defense. And that trial led to the like legal outlaw of basically
Okay.
this form of kidnapping and marriage. But this was in the 90s, right? So it wasn't, that wasn't a very long time ago. So I guess that kind of shows you, I think we were talking about sort of cultures that are, you know, deeply harmful. This was certainly one of them. Yeah. And if that was like culturally sanctioned, it's a culturally sanctioned way of finding a bride, then it becomes unsurprising that the things that happen to the women in this book, they just kind of become unsurprising, right? Like, of course, Kidani's not going to view the struggle that Hirut puts up or his wife's, you know, not even struggle, but like disinterest in, sexual intercourse with him. She was very young when she was married. Astia was very young when she was married. Like all of these things kind of make sense in the context of kind of how the society was constructed and what the society was
Makes a lot of
viewed
sense.
as correct and not. Right. Yeah.
Wow.
Makes sense. What did you think of Ettore and the fact that the imperialist war and the Holocaust were happening around the same time?
Manny, go first.
I think this comes back to the thing that you said earlier, Amar, about having characters that are complicated
Yeah.
and not wholly good or wholly bad, because that's kind of what people are. None of us are really wholly good or wholly bad.
Yeah.
And I thought Ettore was one such character. And I think that, I think there's a lot of depth to like his situation and what it teaches us about the nature of oppression and of being oppressed, and kind of that you can hold those both those places at the same time,
Yeah.
right? Which I think is a very nuanced, very important thing to bring up. I thought it was very interesting and very true to the moment. I think that as Ethiopians, we tend to view as an Ethiopian, or a lot of Ethiopians tend to view, because almost rightly so, because of Italy's colonial aggression, that all the Italians had a certain goal, a certain idea. They were like a homogenous people with the goal of conquering Ethiopia. And I thought it was a very interesting choice for Mazat to put in this character that was also suffering under kind of Italian imperialism and Italian fascism. And it was very interesting that Ettore, and then I guess it also, talks a little bit about, it says something about, the idea of race, that really Ettore had a lot more in common with Ethiopians who are suffering under
Yeah,
fascism than
Jewish.
he did, than he did his fellow, Italian non-Jewish soldiers. And yet for a huge part of the book, he identifies with his compatriots, other
Yeah.
soldiers, and not Ethiopians who were suffering in the same way that he was, which I thought was very interesting.
I found it very interesting. Like, even if I thought he was a weird character, and a lot of reviews I read said he was a bit of a coward, I don't think that's a very easy statement to make because he was in it, right? Bachelor coming out, had a lot to prove, but at the same time wanted to be the good guy. But this, like, he had a lot going on, right? So I don't think it's really fair to label him a coward as such. I've forgotten what I wanted to say.
I think he's trying to find his place within all of this, because he's coming from kind of different backgrounds and identifying with the Ethiopians. So I don't think he was a coward, as they're saying. I think he's trying to find himself and his voice.
I do want to say he did terrible things and was part of very terrible things,
Yes.
in that. So I don't know. It's like, it's really hard to like walk this line without, not really excusing what he did,
Yeah.
right? He should have definitely known better. And not even he should have known better as a person, but like he should, like maybe it feels to me like there was something, like a barrier.
Why should he know better though? Why? Like, he was a soldier. He was given rules that he had to be obeyed. That had to be obeyed. I don't think it
He
was
should
a
have known better when the fascists turned against Italian Jews. That's what I mean by he should have known better,
Well, should
right?
we, would I know better? It's the same way, like back to Uganda, right? It's the same way that we just have double standards as human beings for everything. Like, we are fighting imperialism and like Western, modern colonialism with the whole don't impose LGBTQ on us. But inside, we're still killing ourselves, killing our country. We're still the way we're trying to fight one power from ruling over us is the way we're fighting. We are trying to dominate against queer people that obviously were created that way, right? So we're always faced with double standards, and I just think sometimes it's too much to expect me to just be to know my moral compass at all times. It's just no, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I was like, I guess maybe I am being a little unfair to Ettore, but a part of me just wants to say, like, dude, my guy,
No,
listen, what's happening to
no.
you and your family and your
Yeah.
parents, right? They're being dispossessed by the very government that you are marching with and following orders of, and like the same things that are happening to the Ethiopians that you're photographing, the concentration camps, the
Yeah.
killings, all of that is happening to Jewish folks
That could be a part of trauma as well. When you're kind of being hunted down, and you have the, and then you have, you're given a position where you can, I guess, have your power again. So you hunt other people down.
No, but wait, guys, like, I found it very interesting that I think his dad told that. I specifically told him in a letter that he shouldn't come back. That's very interesting. And also the fact that I think out of like a self-punishment, he did stay back in Ethiopia, but lived a very frugal life and was basically self-punishing right up to the very last. That I found that interesting. What did you think?
The same, like he was trying to, I think he was doing bad things, but at the same time, he was finding himself during that time. And I think he found himself later on. And then his moral compass like kicked in and he felt really bad for what had happened. He analyzed everything and felt really
But
bad.
why do you think his dad told him not to come back? What was that all about?
I mean, I think it was, related to fascist Italy's, implicit and explicit attempt to also eradicate Jewish Italians, right?
Of
There was
course,
really no
influence.
place for Ettore in Italy. Mazza, when she was doing research for the book, she talks a lot about how, and this is true, how sort of the conquest in Ethiopia in some measures was viewed as a territorial expansion for Italy because the southern parts of Italy weren't as fertile as they used to be. Population was sort of growing. So there might have been an element of that as well. Like, there's really nothing for you here. Go make your wealth, your life somewhere else as well. But I think for Ettore specifically, the fact that he was Jewish during World War II also played a part in his, family saying, yeah.
Just to say, I read a bit about like that Italian expansion argument. And yes, during that time, I think the 5 years where they occupied Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somaliland, like quite a mass of Italians came to live in Africa. I found it interesting that over the years, like the Italian influence in Ethiopia is like next to zero. And this was confirmed in a lot of things I read. Is that true in reality?
It's definitely declined over the years, but there's still remnants of it. I was doing some research for this podcast, and someone raised a good point that the language of mechanics in Ethiopia about, like, car parts and things like that is still very Italian, because it was with the Italians that like the popularization of the automobile happened, the coming of the Italians. For instance, a common, goodbye in Ethiopia is ciao. Like in Italian, there are quite a few folks who have Italian family heritage as well. So for a 5-year occupation, I think that it's had some, definitely some lasting impact. But declining.
We have to remember it's 5 years because if Eritrea, on the other hand, was I think for 60 years, six decades, 60 years. So obviously that is way different. Nigeria, British, I think it was over 60, 70 years as well. 1800 to 1960. So 5 years, you have to remember it's quite
What are your
different.
official languages in Ethiopia, out of curiosity?
So in from my knowledge, I don't think there is an official language in Ethiopia. There are actually five official languages in Ethiopia. There's not one. There's more than 80 languages that are spoken in the country. So there's Amharic, Oromifa, Tigrinya, Somali, and Afari are the five
I know
official languages.
Italian.
And no
Even
Italian. No, Italian was never made an official language. There are not,
English,
not English or Italian. Even I think post immediately after the liberation in 41, I don't think there were people did pick up, Italian to communicate, especially in the urban centers, but it was never really like there was never really a program to teach it to people. It kind of just like, oh, some people picked it up, and then the Italians kind of went away, or some people picked it up when engaging with the Italians after liberation a little bit, but it was never like made into an like an institution or a language. It was never used for government or things like that. So these are all like indigenous languages.
Okay, let's move on to the time. Where did the confidence to take down a European army stem from? So I guess this is going back to the question we have of where do Ethiopians get their confidence from?
That's a really good question. I don't know if I can provide like an extensive answer, but I think a lot of people would argue that the victory of Adwa in 1896 did quite a bit to sort of preserve the independent spirit of Ethiopians. I think, Amara, you mentioned that in 86, that was the first time Italy tried to invade and colonize Ethiopia, and they were successfully repelled in a battle that happened on March 1st. It's still a day that March 2nd is still celebrated as the victory of Adwa in Ethiopia every year. I think this March 2nd was the 127th anniversary of that victory. Yeah, so it really stems from having had the experience of repelling a colonizing army and then, you know, being able to maintain that spirit of independence. There's a lot of nuances there and it's very fraught, right? But that's the thing that people point to, I think. I think certainly it's something that Maza sort of brings up here when we were talking about, you know, the spirit that Kidane and the other people had. Yeah. It was, they were recalling what their parents did and what their uncles did during Adwa, aunts and uncles did during Adwa. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, like, the battle in Adwa, like, from the reading I did this week, it was so sound, like, all through the world. It was just, I hear, okay, for instance, that's when Marcus Garvey, is that his name?
Yeah. Yes.
That guy, right? That's when he started his movement using Ethiopia as like the main case study. And I think they started training soldiers as well to help fight the second Italian-Ethiopian war, which is what the book is based on. Is it you that was telling us? Because my loctician, the person that does my hair, is also Ethiopian. So I've been discussing with her. I'm not sure if it's you or her that also said that even because of the war, that Ethiopians were seen as non-Africans because it wasn't possible that Africans who were subhuman could defeat a European feat. Was it you or my loctician?
Yeah. So some, yes, I think it was me. I think that, so some histories and some historical actors point to that. It's hard to say that it was the pervasive view, but there was definitely people who were putting forward that view. Very similar to whenever something, you know, wonderful happens on the continent, non-Africans are thanked for it, right? Like, I think an example is sort of when Zimbabwe, the monument in Zimbabwe was discovered, Zimbabwe, Great Zimbabwe, you know, that people said, oh no, the Africans couldn't have built this. It has to be the Phoenicians who came from the Mediterranean and just sailed all the way here, right? So in keeping with that theme of discrediting Africans for successes, there were definitely actors who put forward that view. And unfortunately, there were Ethiopians who bought into that and still are some Ethiopians who buy into that. But I think a large majority of Ethiopians, or I hope a large majority of Ethiopians then and now, sort of assert their Blackness and their Africanness and know, their brotherhood with everybody else on the continent.
Last question. Was the emperor justified in seeking refuge in another country? I think I'll go first. I think no, don't think he was justified, because I feel like as a leader, as an emperor, you should stick around. Even though it might not be good for you, you need to set the example that, you know, we need to keep fighting. This is for all of us, because not everybody can escape, you know? So that's my view on it. But at the same time, when going through a war, you still need a leader, and you still need a leader to be alive.
Not even that self. Like, I get, like, maybe his ancestors, like Menelik the first, second, third, blah, blah, blah. Like, they were out with swords and spears. But if he was raised in a palace where he read his book and he was just a ceremonial head, what is his business with war and you putting me in the front? What is really my business? I'm literally a figurehead. The queen, when if if Britain was ever like in a serious conflict, they what she'll be doing is just, oh, please, oh, peace, please, peace. But she wouldn't be out there in the war fighting, even if she was kind of in the army for a bit. But again, we all know that was quite, not diminishing her efforts, but they wouldn't put her on the front line, right? So that I think that's where I was coming with. What did you think? What did you think, Manny? How was the mood then? Like, seriously.
Yeah. I mean, so Haile Selassie was the first and only emperor to have ever had the option of exile during conflict. All of the preceding emperors, many of them actually died in conflict, and never took the option of exile. So it was a very new thing for Ethiopians, I think, to experience, and it really broke their spirit. So the Shadow King, of course, is fictional novel. So there was, to my knowledge, no historical equivalent to Minim. And these events likely are, a creation of Maza's imagination. What a lot of historians report, though, is that when the emperor fled, it just really broke the spirit of the resistance. There were still people who resisted for a very long time. But there was not really like a sense of coordination between the resistance, the different arms of the resistance, because of a lack of a figurehead. You also have to remember that this was not in 2023, right? So the emperor from Bath couldn't really communicate with people who had stayed in Ethiopia, right? So it was effectively nobody could reach him, nobody could see him, nobody could talk to him, right? So like the point that like maybe him being alive and well, maybe he could serve as like a rallying call from outside, I don't think happened in reality because he had no means of communicating with people who at that point were fighting like Kidane was guerrilla warfare, right? They were out in the forests and in the bushes and didn't even have access to telegraph, which was the main technology at that time. So people kind of did their own thing. There were nobles at the time, we call them the Mesafint, and members, high-ranking members of the nobility that led resistance, and just everyday average Ethiopians who resisted the Italians in many ways. But the absence of the emperor was kind of devastating, which for me personally is really surprising that he was able. So this the war happened 5 years into his coronation as Negus Negest, which is King of Kings. And then the majority of his reign came after liberation, after 41. And it's very surprising to me that he was able to almost quickly regain the magnanimity that he had.
Like,
After this, right?
Rastafari,
Yeah.
blah, 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 all came about.
Yeah, it was all after, his sort of self-exile. And definitely in the minds of many Ethiopians of the time as well. Like he was very easily able to come back in 41 and assume, the position of absolute power, and all that. So I find that very interesting.
Yeah, thinking about it now, I do too. So
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to change my answer.
No, change it. What? So what happened?
maybe he needed to, I mean, better than dying. If he's a figurehead like that, he left, came back, but he was doing good while he was in Ethiopia during the battle. Do you know what I mean? Like
Even when he was
it
in
drove.
Bath, he was trying to do all the diplomatic, beg for arms, beg for this, beg for that, out, beg for aid.
I can see both sides now. That's what I have to think about. Okay, so this is general discussions about Ethiopia, these next questions. So what were the unique Ethiopian norms or cultures addressed in the book that you can think of, that you can educate us on?
I think just one comes to mind actually, which is I think very early in the book, Hirut is talking about her father teaching her how to shoot a gun. And he tells her to use your right hand, and that's it's a tradition, a habit that's fading slowly, but a lot of Ethiopians, especially Ethiopians who adhere to Orthodox Christianity, are very insistent on the use of the right hand to write, to eat, and basically right hand supremacy.
In Nigerian culture,
Lisa.
same thing. You know, you get
Yeah.
Ashanti, you guys gel well, you're rhyming, she understands your lyrics to songs, and then you pass her a pen with your left hand. And that's when the antiness comes out. Like, what? Why will you do that? Like, it's crazy how they switch. But yeah, I also wanted to ask. So I hear a lot about the Ethiopian church. Is it, are you religious? Do you follow any religion?
So I was born and raised. Born and raised. I wasn't born anything. I was raised Ethiopian Orthodox.
Yeah, is it with the little you know about Christianity and just Pentecostal churches or Catholic churches, is it radically different? Like, what makes it?
Yeah, I think that. So I guess one thing I need to say is that the version of Ethiopia that exists today, with sort of
Yes.
its modern boundaries and all that stuff, came into being really with the reign of Emperor Minilik, the emperor during Adwa,
Yeah.
right? So for a large part of history, what we refer to when we say Ethiopia is what is currently present day northern Ethiopia, the Amhara, the
Yeah,
Tigray, the
Sahara.
Afar regions,
Yeah,
right? Like those regions
above
are.
mountains.
Yeah, so those regions are basically what has had, you know,
Influence.
more or less continuity from before Christ to all the way through now. The southern parts of Ethiopia were incorporated into the state with the reign of Emperor Minilik. So that being said, Christianity was introduced to Ethiopia pretty early in the third decade after Christ. So it came to Ethiopia a lot earlier than the rest of the continent, and that was because you know, Ethiopians at that time had mercantile links with the Middle East, and so Christianity was introduced through that route and became a state religion in, I think, 340 AD during the reign of King Izana of Aksum. So that makes it very unique from Christianity from the rest of the continent, because it was introduced essentially thousands of years ago. It has developed very uniquely. So there are very unique, you know, practices and cultures and
Give
things
us one
around the
example.
liturgy. Oh my gosh. So for instance, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church celebrates the saint days. So there's the day of Saint Michael. Every month there is one, but once a year would be the annual day for Saint Michael or Saint Gabriel or whatever like that. And during that time, there's every church is built, and when it's built in the Holy of Holies, there's a replica of the Ark of the Covenant placed within the church. And during the saint day, if the church is named for a given saint or has an Ark of the Covenant that is sort of given to that saint, then that ark is brought out into the church, and it has like a procession around the church, and there's like a big ceremony around that, which is very unique to the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. Ethiopia, if you ever have a chance to look at, this is one of my favorite things to talk about, just because I think the artistry is amazing. The crosses used in Ethiopia are also very artistic and very decorative, the processional crosses. So that's something else. The gowns worn by the priesthoods, the liturgy,
Me too.
all of that is very different. The liturgical sermons and mass is given in the ancient language, Ge'ez.
Oh,
Not Latin. So many different things like that.
wow. But you guys recognize the Pope?
No, we do not. Ethiopia,
Oh.
yeah. So it is. So Ethiopia is part of the Orthodox sect of Christianity, most similarly related to like the Coptic Church in Egypt, the Russian Orthodox Church, the Greek Orthodox Church. But none of these churches have like one figurehead leader, like, you know, Catholicism. So Ethiopia
Really?
has its own patriarch of the church. Actually, fun fact, until the reign of Haile Selassie, the patriarch used to be assigned by the Coptic Church in Egypt, in Alexandria. And then during the reign of Haile Selassie, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church and the Coptic Church sort of broke apart, and Ethiopia started to elect the Ethiopian Orthodox Church started to elect the head or the patriarch from within its own ranks. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so sorry. What myth have you heard about Nigeria that you want to clear up?
Oh, I don't know if there's any myths that I feel like I need clearing up on. So for more information, I guess, when I came to the United States for undergrad, I made friends with Africans from all over.
Yeah.
And I made friends with a ton of Nigerians. So I feel like
if
I had any myths about Nigeria coming in,
they
were very summarily cleared out by my friends who I'm
so
very,
what
very
happened to visit Nigeria?
You know, I really want to. The fact that I actually happen to be, I'm not American by citizenship or anything, I'm Ethiopian. And, you know, if there are people in the African Union listening to this podcast, I'm begging you on my hands and knees to make travel between the African countries so much more accessible. So that's why I haven't gone to Nigeria, is because it's so hard.
Yeah. And what would be like the one thing you would look forward to if you visited Nigeria? What have you heard that you're just like, okay, this is why I need to go?
I hear that people are super friendly and that the nightlife is just like fantastic. Some of the best in the world, and dancing and music. I used to be in an African dance group in when I was an undergraduate.
Yeah, we all were. All of us.
Yeah. So
in the motherland.
Yeah. So, I mean, I dance to a lot of Nigerian pop music, and I feel like it would be an unreal experience to be able to do that in Nigeria itself.
Okay, so we're going to go into the final part of this podcast where we share maybe our favorite things from the book or any quotes that we remember that we want to talk about. So Manny, I'll ask you, what was your favorite part of the book?
What was my favorite part of the book? I don't know if I would say my favorite part of the book, but I kind of want to talk a little, like I'm going to take this opportunity to bring up a part of the book that I think has continuity throughout to all of Mazza's work so far, her two novels. And it's sort of the almost like the being in the emperor's head and being in the emperor's thoughts, I think was a very interesting aspect of this book. Obviously something that Mazza does not have access to really, but imagined. And I thought it was interesting because her first novel, Beneath the Lion's Gaze, actually takes place in the period 1974 onwards, which is right when this second book ends. And she does a very similar thing there, where she is in the emperor's, you know, she writes chapters in the point of view of the emperor or in the emperor's mind. And I thought that that was very interesting continuity for Mazza. And but kind of captures.
Could you relate to what? Because that was unfortunately my least favorite part of the book. But for you, like reading it as an Ethiopian, like some of the things she mentioned as the things he imagined, does it resonate with you? Or
I don't know about resonate, but I mean, if Mazza had written this book 50 years ago, it would have been apocryphal. Because the emperor was untouchable. And in the mythology of Ethiopians and Ethiopianism, the emperor Haile Selassie is one of those towering, untouchable figures, right? Unimaginable charisma. You know, just to give you a context, when the emperor's car drives by, people prostrate themselves on the ground and dare not to even look at the emperor, right? Like that's how, for some people, and I'm sure Haile Selassie himself, you know, built up this reputation, and the nobles also built this up for him. But that's how kind of powerful the idea of the man was. And Mazza does this thing where she more than humanizes him, right? There's points where you end up pitying this emperor and this person, and you view him as a father and sort of as this sad little figure. I mean, the book ends with the emperor in peasant's clothes at the station meeting up with Hirut, who used to guard the fake emperor, and she walks him to the palace, right? It's kind of like, oh, this feeble old man. And it's very much the same in Beneath the Lion's Gaze, and especially so because Beneath the Lion's Gaze talks about the revolution and a coup that removed the emperor and ultimately had him assassinated, right? So this, like, it's very different from what is the canonical view, or what has been the historical canonical view of the emperor. And so I think that's very interesting and a very interesting choice.
I have so many questions to ask you about Ethiopia. I just think it's a badass country that, everyone should study.
Yeah. It is a badass country, but I also wanted to say that it's a very complicated country.
Yeah.
And it is a country, especially the what we think of as modern Ethiopia, it's a country that was birthed through conquest and empire. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, and so there's a lot of trauma associated with that, and there's a lot of important questions that need to be addressed about, okay, we're one country now, but how did we get here? How did we get here, and what does that mean for who we are? Especially relating as it relates to the emperors, the emperors undertook a campaign of conquest within what is modern day Ethiopia in order to make modern day Ethiopia, right? And so that makes it, a very fraught place.
Off the back of that, so you said there's about 80 languages, right?
Yeah.
So how does that mesh as a country? How does a country see themselves as one if it's so diverse?
Yeah. I don't know if the country sees itself as one. There have been attempts in many forms to make it that way, and personally, I don't know if being able to live together and in cooperation and in harmony, I don't know what that means, and I think that's something that we as a nation have to, like, constantly be asking and looking for. Back in the day, it was just people learned to speak many different languages, right, of the provinces and regions neighboring them, so that they could have, like, a mercantile economy, so that they could exchange goods, so that, whatever. There's a lot of intermarriage and things like that. And then when empire building happened, each of the emperors had a different strategy to empire building. Some of them was kind of like, okay, you'll pay some taxes, but for the most part, we're going to consider you like an independent entity. You keep your languages, you keep your customs, whatever, we don't interfere. And then the other emperors were like, no, I'm going to impose my language and my culture and all of that on you. Yeah. Haile Selassie's reign was one of deeply trying to centralize Ethiopia and impose a national language, impose a national religion. So sort of like homogenize and unify everyone. Which has meant that some people rightly don't view the memory of Haile Selassie very positively, right? And view it associated with sort of an erasure of their indigenous culture. So it's a really hard question, and it's not one that Ethiopia's answered by any means. And it's still a question that we struggle with today.
I remember, like, in highlights of 2018 or 2019 was when your current prime minister or president, like, received a Nobel Peace Prize, and or like the spotlight was on Ethiopia. And I don't want to, like, drag this conversation, but I just wanted to say it's quite sad that exactly what you're saying, those complexities are coming out in full force, even with his reign. The conversations are getting louder, politically, we can see what's going on. There was a recent famine almost, or food shortage, and just the complexities between the tribes. And so, I've been reading about that quite a lot. And it's funny because, as I said, someone I know is Ethiopian, and they take it is a unique side. But if you ask another person, it's different. Totally different. It's like Nigeria as well. Like, if you ask an Igbo person or a Hausa person. So it's not, to be honest, the Ethiopian situation is not unique. It's exactly what we're going We were put together. So you've said conquest, but we say colonialists.
Right,
You put us
exactly.
together as a country, and we've just not we've just not seen the light of day since then. Yeah.
Yeah, it's something I always think about, like what would make it better?
That's the thing, what will make it better? We can't keep looking to the past, so
To a certain extent, but I also think this is my personal opinion, but I think that it requires some sort of redress because although the past is in the past, I think there's things in the present that are very much directly related to two things that happened in the past, right? There's people who have benefited and who have been hurt, and I think there has to be some form of redress and some form of honest conversation, which a lot of people in Ethiopia are advocating for Ethiopia. Yeah, I don't know if there's like very good models of that exist or how that looks, but
See, there are no good models because we're all, for lack of better word, we've all been brainwashed to the Western style of thinking. Look at you, look at me, look at all of us, like talking about Africa, but we're still in England. We've had all our education here. We want our children to be brought up here. So it's just a cycle. Like Africa is always just going to be left to one side, because yeah, I don't know. But let's not
A whole other conversation.
whole conversation. All right. So
What's your favorite part of the book?
yeah, as I said, anything related to the emperor, I was just like, okay, I was listening to it on Audible, so I think that at that point I used to just pick up my phone. My favorite part was actually Fifi and the cook. I don't know why. I guess I was just interested in what the cook had to do next. She was always up to something hidden, but hidden but useful. So that was my favorite part of the book. And then just hearing about the wins, I was always so happy when like there was a victory and they attacked the Italian camp, and I remember like two men crawled up the war tank or something to switch off something. Yeah, that was a good. I used to just listen to it while making food. So, yeah.
My favorite part, although I anything to do with rape, it makes me
Yeah.
cringe. But when Hirut was in that process getting raped, I think I was on the treadmill or something. And so when it described that her mind kind of escaped and went to a higher place and kind of overcame, I was running. I was like, yes, I can do this. If I could condition my mind to keep
Oh,
running
yeah.
and get over this pain that I'm feeling. So I guess it just kind of made me recognize the mind power, the
Mental.
mental power that we are capable of if we want to get something done and overcome something. So that was my favorite part.
Guys, quick question. Did you guys think this was a romance novel between Ettore and Hirut?
In the beginning.
So this book, it had its good and bad days for me, and it took me like three or four rereads from page 1 to 50 to actually get into the book. But in the beginning, during that train, the train scene where she was at the station and she'd been traveling for like 4 days, and there was this box of letters. I was like, this has to be, she's
I
going
love
to meet her love, like
that.
Ettore. And throughout the book, maybe because I really didn't read the beginning well, I was like, okay, so when did they get to meet? And literally, they never met. They met, and I think all they learned from each other is how to say to die. That's literally it. So throughout the whole book, even when she was captured, I was like, okay, I don't like the fact she's been captured, but like she's going to meet Ettore, the love of her life. I mean, I'm happy she ended up with Akinu, but I literally thought it was going to be another. She's not cliche. I'm always happy for a new rom-com, but I really thought it was going to be,
A sort of love story that came together for you
yeah, the
that connected.
Italian versus like the Abyssinian girl. But yeah.
I'm
Anyway,
really glad Maza subverted that expectation then.
I'm so happy as well. Even if it would have been an easier read for me, but I'm happy.
Anything else that you want to say, Manny, before we close?
About the book, I mean, I kind of want to say that it's an excellent book. It's been nominated for, multiple awards. It took Mazat 10 years to write it. She learned Italian to do so. So it was definitely like a feat. And then I think implicit in this conversation is the fact that Mazat's highlighting the stories of women in war, which is definitely not the has not been the case in Ethiopia. I In preparation for this podcast, I was flipping through some of my history books on Ethiopia that I have. And like all history books, it's Ras somebody, the Jasmach somebody left, those are the titles for people, Negusa Negest somebody, and they are invariably all male. And I think we know, as in Ethiopia, I think we know like by tradition that there were women followers in the war, like women in the war as well, providing medical aid and things like that. But very rarely do we talk about women actually fighting in the war, which they did. And I'm really glad Mazat wrote this story to highlight, the very thankless patriotism that women also showed. So I think, yeah, so I think it's great and unique in that way. And she actually found out after she'd written a good part of this book that her great grandmother actually also took the gun like Hirut did and went to fight.
She wrote the book because of that. It's interesting
No.
to hear that.
Yeah, she found out like when she'd written a good chunk of the book. I think it was in the final stages, and she went to Ethiopia, and she's telling her mother. So in it, with this book as a companion, Maza has some on her website. You can find it like pictures taken during the war. By the way, fun fact, the like gruesome pictures of Ethiopians being killed and blah 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 were indeed made into postcards and sent to Italy by the soldiers. That is like fact. But there were other po postcards of just like Ethiopian people or whatever, just like doing normal things as well. And she's collected some of those and put them up. And she found one of a woman soldier holding a gun, and she showed it to her mom, I think. And her mom, and she was like, "Wow, look at this, mom! Like, my book that I wrote, I actually found the picture." And her mother was like, "Yeah, but your great grandmother also did this. Like, it's nothing special." And Mazal was like, "I've been writing an entire book about this, and you didn't think to mention it to me," which kind of kind of explains that people kind of just like never talk about it, never elevate it. And so I'm glad Mazal did.
I guess one last thing for me. I had to read this book twice. Well, listen to it on Audible.
Oh, you listened to it twice.
Actually, I didn't finish the second time, but I got through most of it the second time. So at first, I didn't really like it because I thought it was too descriptive
Everyone says
and
that.
repetitive.
Everyone says that. She doesn't like quotation marks too, speech marks.
So I was like, it was really hard for me to get into. But Amra suggested I read it again, which I did. And I was like, things are starting to connect. I could kind of see why she was being repetitive. And it kind of sets like a musical tone to it. So I'll say that I appreciate that once that I didn't like before, but I understand why she did it. Yeah, it's a good book. I liked it a lot. Made me have more of an interest in Ethiopia, especially what you said about Ethiopian Orthodox Church. Now I want to go to one and see the artwork
Same.
and
I mean, I also want to point out that like Islam in Ethiopia has a very, very rich, equally rich history and has been practiced in Ethiopia for basically as long as Islam has existed. Yeah. Ethiopia is very, I think in some places touted as like, a Christian nation, and that's not true. It's about 50-50 currently. And yeah, some of the holiest, some of the like very holy sites in Islam exist in Ethiopia. The oldest mosque in Ethiopia exists in the same region as the oldest church in Ethiopia. So it's like, yeah. So please, if you're going to look into that as well and the relationship between the two. Yeah.
Putting that on my bucket list.
Yep.
Yeah. So, do you want to plug your book club?
Yeah, I would. So I guess I was able to come to this on to this podcast. Thank you again for having me. It's been really fun to like go through the Shadow King again and do research for this. But I was able to do all of that because we connected on via my book club that I'm a part of, based in Boston, but we are open to members from all over the world, all over the country. Really, we can meet over Zoom. Sometimes we do actually. Mm-hmm. And if you're interested, you can give us a follow on Fede Lit Arts. So that's FEEDEL_LITARTS on Instagram. We post all of the books that we're reading. So even if you aren't interested in joining, you can just sort of stay up to date to like what people are reading and get book recommendations and stuff from us. So
do you guys meet up?
We do, yes.
Okay, so
we try to.
That area.
Yeah, we try to sometimes meet up face to face. Sometimes we meet up over Zoom, even if we're meeting in person. If we know that there are people who want to like be part of it, we will have like Zoom on.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's a great community. We do fun things. We often celebrate like the anniversary of the book club's formation with like a party, or we do like Christmas holiday parties. And I think I like to say that we're also like genuinely friends too. So
that's the best. Yeah. All right. So this comes, we're at the end of our podcast. The next book that we're going to be reading is First Woman by Jennifer Makumbi. So we're going to Uganda.
Uganda!
Which is exciting. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe, and follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Our handle for all three platforms is AfroReads Podcast. So if you happen to read the book discussing this podcast, we'd love to hear your thoughts. So please comment if you can. And we will be sharing other interesting content on our social platforms and have some informative discussions leading up to the next episode. We're looking forward to you joining us on the next episode. But until then, take care and have a blessed week.